The Triathlon Show, 176. Hey, what's up everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and on today's episode I interview Professor Sebastian Šitko from the University of Zaragoza. In addition to being an academic, Sebastian is also an endurance sports coach with a particular focus on cycling and a passionate athlete himself. So we will talk about topics from both an academic and scientific and also from a coaching perspective in today's interview. But first, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. They help athletes perform at their best with electrolyte and fueling products and free online tools, education, and a patented sweat test. You can use the free fuel and hydration planner on the Precision Fuel and Hydration website to get a personalized plan for your carbohydrate, sodium, and fluid intake. And you can also book a free 20-minute video consultation to chat through your plan with their athlete support team. As a salty sweater myself, their highly concentrated electrolytes are super important to me in long workouts and races. And I think there are no gels that are as good and easy to consume, even in large quantities, as the Precision Fuel gels. You can get 15% off your first order by using the code TTS23 on precisionfuelandhydration.com. And thank you to Senate. The Senate Indoor Swim Trainer is a unique dryland swim trainer that allows you to improve your technique, power, and swim training consistency. It is a perfect tool to complement your pool and open water swimming, as it allows you to do very specific power and technique work, including working your catch and your core activation, and it makes it easier to stay consistent even when you can't go to the pool. You can even use it to do activation work before a pool or open water swim, or to do swim bike brick workouts more easily. You can try the Senate risk-free for up to 30 days, so if you don't love it, just send it back, and you can get a special TTS bundle including the swim bench and a bunch of Senate training plans and on-demand workouts on senateswimtrainer.com/TTS. Now without any further ado, here's my interview with Professor Sebastian Šitko. Welcome to the Triathlon Show, Sebastian. How are you doing?
Hi there, Michael. Thank you. I'm fine, and you?
Yeah, good. Thank you. Let's start with an introduction. Who are you? Tell us a bit more about yourself.
Okay. I'm Sebastian Šitko. I'm currently a lecturer at the University of Zaragoza, which is located in the north of Spain, in the Faculty of Health and Sports Sciences. I'm also a researcher at the same faculty, and I also have a small coaching business in which I coach mainly road cyclists.
Great. And I think you've also consulted with or worked with some pro teams or pro cyclists anyways. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah. And also triathletes and trail runners I read on your website.
Yeah, I currently coach some triathletes and trail runners, but to be honest, most of my coached athletes are cyclists.
All right, great. So we have a few topics that I put in our document so that we can discuss today. And what first, I want to talk a little bit about threshold concepts and FTP. And also VO2 max, because they all kind of, let's say when you go to a lab, like these are all things that you can measure, or FTP you can measure at home or on the road. But let's start with training prescription. When you prescribe training, how do you do it? Do you do it based on some percentage or threshold or training zones that are anchored around thresholds, or what is your method?
Well, here I would talk about two different topics. First would be all the low intensity work, which will be, for example, at the start of the season or after an injury, etc. In these cases, I like to use heart rate based on percentages of maximal heart rate. Why? Because in these cases, it's easy to see how after a while the power output associated to the same heart rate is increasing. Okay, why do I do this way? Because it's very difficult to test the first ventilatory threshold, for example, with the power output. We currently don't have a method to do so. So it's quite easy to do so with heart rate. At intensities that are located above that, the things change a little bit, because it's very difficult to measure not only VO2 max intensities but also threshold intensities with heart rate, because this is an internal variable that varies a lot between different days, conditions, heat, humidity, etc. So in these cases, I prefer to use power output. But you have to take into account that even in these cases, it's, you need to set up broad ranges of power output, because even if you use FTP, the thing is that FTP is not a stable marker. So for example, I have tested this with my athletes, and if you perform three different FTP tests during the same week, you will see three different power outputs associated to FTP. So in these cases, you know, you cannot say that your FTP is 360 watts, because that may be the case one day, but after 2 days, maybe different. Mm-hmm. I have seen, for example, 360 on Monday, 380 on Wednesday, and 340 on Saturday. Mm-hmm. So when you are doing threshold work, that's what I want to say, is that you need to set up broad ranges. So for example, okay, we're going to work your threshold pace, let's say from 340 to 380 watts. So to be sure that you are working in that range, no? So that's how I do this work. And yes, I work around percentages of FTP, because I think that that's quite a good marker of sustainable performance. We have done several papers on this topic, and we have seen that normally it's if you set up your FTP according to the test suggested by Allen and Kogan, for example, you have a marker of performance that can be sustained over 40 to 70 minutes of time until exhaustion. So I think that's a quite good margin, which is very similar to what you would find with the maximal lactate stable state, for example, and a little bit below what you would find with the second ventilatory threshold or the respiratory compensation point.
So that paper that you refer to is called Time to Exhaustion at Estimated Functional Threshold Power in Road Cyclists of Different Performance Levels. It was really interesting. Actually, I have only read the abstract because it wasn't. I couldn't find it, but I'll ask you for a copy later. But in the abstract, you can still see the results, and I think that the kind of not trained people, that don't really train, they were doing, was it 35 to 40 minutes, and then the kind of trained cyclists 40 to 50 minutes, was it 40 minutes, 40 to 45, and very well trained 50 minutes or so. So, but you had some people that were doing up to 70 minutes there. So when you say the that you follow the Hunter Allen and Andrew Coggan protocol, do you mean the exact protocol, including also the 5 minute all out test in the warm up? And
yeah, that's very important, because in the recent years, we have seen lots of papers who say that, the FTP performed as suggested by Allen and Coggan is not correct, blah, blah, blah. The fact is that when you take a look at these papers, you see that they have just done a 20-minute interval. Of course, a 20-minute interval won't reflect as well the 60-minute power as if you perform all the suggested warm-up intervals before the 20-minute interval. Because, yep. You know, for example, you have a 5-minute interval, which is all out, and that generates lots of fatigue.
Yeah.
That will provide a reduced power output during the 20-minute interval, which, in fact, will correlate better with 60-minute power. Hmm. So that's very important when we are talking about this protocol, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And so if you come back to the prescription of, let's say, threshold training or anything higher than the first lactate or ventilatory threshold, then would you, with all your athletes, do multiple FTP tests to get an idea of the variation, or is that just something you did for experiment with some athletes? And would your normal protocol be to do one FTP test and then you would take a range? Let's say you coach me and I come to you and I do 360 watts, one can dream. Would you say that, okay, now you go and do your intervals at 320 to 360, so you take like that test result that I did and a bit lower, or how would you work?
Yeah, the thing I explained earlier was just an experiment I did with some athletes of different levels. This is not published in science, but it's important to support the fact that you need to fix like super broad ranges when you perform threshold training. And as you told me, yeah, I will probably take the result of a test and 20, 25 watts up and down, and that will be the place where I want you to work, no? Mm.
And what about if you do a VO2 max workout, so let's say 5 times 4 minutes or something like that? How would you prescribe that kind of workout?
Yeah, to improve VO2 max, there are like two main types of intervals which have been studied in science. The first one is like the classical 40-20s, which is 20 seconds almost all out, then 40 seconds just under threshold. And then the type of intervals that you have proposed earlier. No, this second type of intervals normally work, as we have seen in science, work a little bit better. Explained as time spent at VO2 max intensity, which, and here I raise a question because this has not been studied. Does this mean that if you spend more time at VO2 max intensity, it will automatically improve your VO2 max? We have not science to support that, okay? It may seem logical. You say, okay, I spend 20 minutes at this intensity. It's much better than to spend 12 minutes. But we do not know that, okay? So if you want to work to improve your VO2 max, I would definitely go towards this type of intervals. But I'm not that sure that more is better here, okay?
Mm. Yeah. But what is the prescription like? Would you, like, if you give a workout to one of your athletes, do you say go as hard as you can for whatever the workout is, or do you give a specific power number or something like that?
Yeah, I normally look at the power curve. So for example, imagine that we are working with three minutes in intervals. Okay, first you try to expand the time spent at this intensity. So for example, longer intervals each time, or less the same duration of session but less rest. And once the availability of the athlete and the fatigue that the session generates doesn't allow you to increase more the time spent at the VO2 max intensity, then you test, and normally you will increase the power output. Okay, that's the way I do it.
Okay, and coming back to the low intensity, so with the heart rate based prescription, what would the percentage of max? You said that you do it with percentage of maximum heart rate. What kind of percentage do you use for that low intensity training?
Yeah, here we have like two different theories. There are people who set up a heart rate threshold, which in my experience varies a lot during the season. And there are other people like me who prescribe it according to the maximal heart rate, which also in my experience varies a lot less during the season. Normally I take everything between 60 to 75% of maximal heart rate for this kind of work.
Mm. So that's a pretty broad range, and then the athlete can choose based on how they feel within that range. Is that correct?
It varies a lot according to each individual, because you know there are people who live in a surrounded by a terrain in which it is difficult to sustain if it's very mountainous, it's very difficult to sustain exact same heart rate because you have up and downs, etc. So in that case, the range will be a little bit broader. And then you have people who are super like centered and have perfect terrain for this kind of work. Then you can narrow the range a little bit.
Okay, but would you narrow it based on other factors as well? Like if you know that some athletes maybe need to do their low intensity training a bit easier, maybe because they have high volume in totals, or would you then say okay, 60-65%, but somebody with a busy job and not so much time to train, then they might do 70-75, or would that be a factor?
Yeah, of course. Each prescription must be individualized, because in the end, there are like two main factors that will determine what kind of training you perform with the athletes. And these two factors are, first, what is the objective? Because the training for an Ironman won't be the same as the training for a criterium race, for example. The amount of low intensity work that you need to do in these two cases is totally different. And second factor for me is the most important for all amateur athletes, which is the availability. Okay, so yes, of course, if you have 25 hours per week to train, of course you can perform 80% of your time at zone two.
Yeah,
but that's not the case in most amateur athletes. They have like 8 hours or 10. So in that cases, you need to up a little bit the intensity if you want results.
Hmm. And coming back to FTP again and some of the studies that you've done there. So we mentioned already the work with the time to exhaustion, how long athletes can ride at FTP, and the conclusion there was that, well, if you do the protocol as originally proposed, including all the warm-up and the 5-minute all-out before the 20-minute test, then it works quite well and it gets you in the right range where you would expect a threshold to be, which is that kind of 40 to 70 minutes. You have also tested how it compares to the lactate and ventilatory thresholds. So can you talk about that? Like, what did you find when you did that comparison?
Yeah, like to differentiate here between ventilatory and lactate thresholds, it's FTP, as determined by the Allen and Cogan test, correlates quite well with the second ventilatory threshold and also the respiratory compensation point, which doesn't mean that it is equal. It just correlates. So if one increases, the other increases also. Mm. Okay. But both of the thresholds, ventilatory thresholds, are located a little bit above, okay, the
yeah.
FTP. FTP is located more or less at the same intensities as maximal lactate stable state, okay? Mm. And also lactate threshold tested through different methods such as modified Dmax test, for example. But still, I will stay with this maximal lactate stable state, which is quite common and well understood. Okay, and if you try to research papers that have tested the time to exhaustion at the maximal lactate stable state, you will find that the time to exhaustion is quite similar to what we have found for the FTP. Okay,
yeah.
So I think that's quite a good marker of sustainable performance, because when you test the time to exhaustion at the respiratory compensation point, for example, you will find that it's like 20 to 25 minutes.
Yeah.
So it's like that's not a sustainable performance for me. Okay.
Yeah. And here I think this is really important information, actually. And this is one of the reasons that I wanted to talk to you when I found your papers, that when you go to a lab and you do a test with a metabolic cart, you put on the mask and you measure your VO2 max and everything and your ventilatory thresholds, maybe your fat and carb oxidation, all those sorts of fancy things, then the researchers will give you a report, or the lab technicians will give a report with your thresholds and your VO2 max and your maximum heart rate. But the thing that I see almost in every single case with those tests is that it's just, if you try to follow those thresholds and those training zones, it's just rubbish, and you're going to train like it's going to be a disaster, basically. Because here, as you say, If the 20-25 minutes or something like that was the time to exhaustion at the respiratory compensation point, so that kind of what we might call thresholds colloquially, then that's just something that is not at all sustainable. And then you try to do intervals there a couple of times per week, and of course it's going to be really, really hard, versus then something that you can hold for 40 to 70 minutes, and maximum lactate steady state is probably the only definitional threshold that science can agree on. Like, okay, this is exactly what the definition should be, compared to even things like Dmax or 4 millimoles or all the different markers we have for lactate thresholds. So I think that's a really good thing for FTP to be so similar to maximum lactate steady state. And again, as you pointed out, correlation is not the same as being the same. So in the papers, you will calculate something that you'll basically say like how even if it correlates well, but it's still different. So it's going to be below those markers. So my point with all of this, with this little rant to the listeners, is if you go to a lab, the only time that I want my athletes to go to a lab to do a test with a metabolic cart would be if I want to know their VO2 max. And if I want to know their training zones, I would prescribe them for more of a lactate test, like a, let's say, 5-minute stages, and you do a lactate test or an FTP test or a critical power test, something like that, because I think that you can't really get the training zones from a from that VO2 max test, if you want to call it that, with the metabolic cart. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, completely. I think that VO2 max as a marker for the prescription of training is rubbish. You know, you cannot prescribe training as a percentage of VO2 max. I do find VO2 max interesting for talent detection. Okay, so yep. For example, it has been known. This has been known for a long time. If you are testing, you know, young adults, you know, junior riders, etc., you need to find values of 70 or above in VO2 max if you need a winner. And there are several other factors which are. I'm talking here about road cycling, okay?
And male road cyclists.
Male road cyclists, yeah. There are, of course, several other factors which, you know, are super important, but this is like a standard value. So if you're under that, let's take a look at the other values, but it doesn't look very good for you. Okay. So, you know, the fact is that currently we can estimate quite well the VO2 max with power output, for example, during 5 minute intervals. So, with this information, you can go to, you know, like a third world place in which you don't have a laboratory, and you can just with a power meter, which can be paired to your pedals, you can do a nice job doing talent selection, for example.
Yeah. So that's another study you did. So correlating the five minute maximum power with VO2 max. So we will link to that study in the show notes, and in the abstract already you can see the equation. So listeners can go and have a look, and you can do a 5 minute power test, and then you can calculate, well, what is your estimated VO2 max. The one thing that you can't see in the paper because it wasn't open access is what is the error. So can you talk a bit more about what is the error or the variance between individuals with how accurate that test is?
Yeah, the problem with this test in our study was that we wanted to test across all performance levels. Mm. So you need like a very stable sample size, okay? So you need 12 athletes of this level, 12 of the other one, etc. So the sample size was quite reduced. I think it was like 50 subjects, more or less, 46, something like that. I don't remember exactly. So with this, we found the formula quite accurate, but of course it will be improved if you test like 200 cyclists. But of course it's very difficult to find like 30 top level cyclists for your sample to go to your laboratory and perform testing, etc. No? So the accuracy was like plus minus 5 milliliters per kilo of weight, something like that. Yeah, which may seem a lot.
Yeah,
you say okay, that's a lot, but when we tested it in the laboratory, it reflected super well. The 5 minute power output reflected super well what we found in the incremental test.
Right.
So even from the statistical point of view, it may seem a lot. Like, oh my god, that's useless. It is not. Okay. Mm.
Yeah, that's interesting. One other thing about VO2 max is that in addition to talent detection, another scenario where it can be useful is maybe you want to know if you try to work on VO2 max, well, did you actually, you do a VO2 max block, did it actually improve? But what I find there is that, well, you don't need to know what the VO2 max is, you just need to know if you improved, so you can do the 5 minute test before and after. What I do quite often is do a ramp test because now Swift and, for example, use a ramp test to calculate FTP, which I think is not good, but it's great to see changes in VO2 max. That's something that another guest on the podcast talked about before. Michael Rosenblatt has done some work there. And I think, yeah, changes in, for example, the ramp test output can be really well reflective of all changes in VO2 max as well. So that's another tip.
Yeah, the problem with ramp test and VO2 max testing, and I have seen this a lot in the lab, is that you almost always don't obtain the true VO2 max value. Okay, so, and this can be performed in the lab quite easily. If you perform a lab test, incremental lab test, I don't care about the duration. If you end up in the stage, whichever you want, you leave a little bit of rest. And after that, you set up another stage, which is a little bit harder than the last one. Normally, this is called a supramaximal verification phase, okay? You will see a value that it's that is higher than what you obtained in the last stage of the incremental.
Yeah.
So what I'm telling you here is that all the previous work you are you have performed during the incremental test before the last stages is generating a fatigue that may, you know, be a confounding factor in the VO2 slow component, and in the end reflects as a lower than expected value of VO2 max.
When you do an incremental test, I've heard, is it, correct me if I'm wrong, but like you want it to, you want to reach exhaustion within 12 minutes usually. That's a number that I've heard. So basically you need to plan your ramp rate and your starting power accordingly. So that's, for example, what I do if I have athletes that I want to do a ramp test. I don't tell them do the Swift ramp test, but I plan it according to the athlete's level. And I always set the ramp rate to be 25 watts increase every minute, which is a common one that you see in labs, but there are in some labs they will do 15 watts per minute or even 10 watts per minute, and that's often those longer tests where you don't end up reaching VO2 max because you fatigue too much, so you can't quite reach it.
Yeah, from what science has to say, I would say that if you want to test VO2 max, the shorter the test, the better. And if you want to test thresholds, which I would not recommend with an incremental test, but
yeah,
people still do it anyways, the longer the test, the better.
Yeah, I think that's a situation probably where labs need to make their test valuable. So that's why they give the report with the thresholds and the zones from the incremental test, so that athletes feel like they get value from it. But in the end, it hurts more than it helps.
But, yeah, I think that kind of testing, I think it's outdated, and you know, it's just in a few years' time, it will be, you know, nobody will perform it.
Yeah. So when you work with an athlete, let's say it's an amateur athlete, but it's somebody with some ambitious goals. They want to like do some races and try to maybe place well and so on, and improve their FTP and what have you, get faster in general. What are the tests that you do? Talk to us about the testing that you would recommend for the athlete.
Okay, so before starting, I will perform anthropometric tests just to see the body composition, because that will direct the training of the next month. Imagine that you have some body fat to lose; that will be an important factor to take into account during the first months. Okay. Carbohydrate and fat oxidation rates are interesting to test for, also for the first months, because that, you know, gives you an intensity at which, you know, you can improve those values, which may be important in the first months. And the last thing I would test for in the laboratory nowadays would be the gross efficiency. Okay, so the work rate at which you are using an exact amount of oxygen, okay? Those are the values that may be interesting in the lab. For the rest, if you want to lactate test...
For those tests first, fat oxidation and carb oxidation and gross efficiency, what is the testing protocol that you would use for those tests?
For those tests, I will use an RAM protocol with super long steps. We are talking here 7 minutes even for each stage. Okay.
Okay. Yeah, and then you were going to say
lactate. For example, I'm not a super fan of lactate. It's another internal metric like heart rate, so it varies a lot according to nutrition. Blah blah blah. But still, I will test lactate like 3 times per year for an amateur athlete. So the first time would be just before starting, okay? The second time would be after the preparation phase to see if everything went as planned, and before the first competitions, even if they are preparatory. And the last one, just before the most important competition of the training year, okay? Mm. But as I told you, I'm not super fan of lactate testing. And of course, power test for an entire power curve, okay? Mm. You may obtain that with preparatory competitions. So if you are, you know, like doing some competitions, you don't even need to test. And the last one, which is not super talked about, but I think that's very important, is in order to monitor fatigue, the relationship between power output and subjective perception of effort. Okay, so we are talking here about tests that are normally under threshold, and you are monitoring with the Borg scale to see whether you know he is where he should be. So, for example, I prescribe like a short, just under threshold interval for the first 5-10 minutes after the warm up. And if the rate of perceived exertion is where it should be, then the athlete is allowed to perform the rest of the intervals. If not, he just, you know, do like zone 2 and go home.
Mm, yeah, got it. And what about if an athlete is self-coached? What would you, a typical self-coached athlete, they are interested and they listen to some podcast and read some stuff, but they're not, you know, a researcher, and they don't have like an extensive knowledge. They don't have, they're not a coach either. What are the things that you would recommend they do? Like, would you recommend for them to keep things more simple than doing all the tests that you would have an athlete do?
Yeah, for sure. In the end, we should acknowledge that most of the stuff we are doing in the training world are not science-based or not super science-based. So in the end, you are working with just experience. It may be a very good experience, but still experience. As the athlete won't have access to that kind of experience that a long-lasting coach has, I will keep things super simple, just test the most important power outputs, which would be, for me, for example, 1 minute, 5 minute, 20 minutes. Also, if you are doing criteriums or stuff like that, 5 seconds, for example. With that, you can use the 5 minute test to assess your VO2 max, the 20 minute test, as I have explained previously, to assess your FTP. And with that, you can, you know, train properly.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense to as well learn to do the basics really well before you start to add some more bells and whistles. Because there's usually a lot of things that you can do better, and this is something that I come back to often as a coach as well. Like before starting to think about like the newest or the more advanced things, like well. Is there some basic things that I still can improve with? Basically, I think that's always a good question to ask yourself, no matter what you're doing. Let's get into some training concepts and training questions. What are your general thoughts around volume and intensity, and how to get the right balance between those?
Yeah, we are always talking lots of stuff about these two topics. It goes by trends. So for example, now it seems that on the internet we are talking more about volume than intensity. Zone 2 training, volume is super important. For me, in my experience, it really is a fact of what's about your availability and your goals. Okay, so that two factors will mark everything you do with this combination of volume and intensity. So if you are planning to do an Ironman, for example, then of course, in my opinion, your training should be based more around volume than intensity, because in the end, you will perform lots of hours at very low intensities. But if you are doing instead like short road races or criteriums in these cases, and especially if you have not a lot of time, it will be more interesting to invest in intensity than volume.
Mm, yeah. And what is the variation there? Like, do you have athletes there's a lot, another trend is the whole 80-20 number. But I'm sure that you don't really follow that number, but do you have athletes that are more like 50-50 or like that? Is there a big variation basically?
Yeah, in order to explain the variation, I can tell you that, for example, a pro road cyclist is, it could be quite close to that 80-20 number. Eh? So 80% of the time, you know, like a very easy work. But that's just because they perform lots and lots of hours weekly. For example, we are talking about 25 to 30 hours weekly. So imagine that out of these 30 hours, like 40% was intensity. It would be impossible to recover from that. Okay, so So that number is reduced to that just because of this factor, okay? But I have also like amateur athletes who have like 7-8 hours per week. And in those cases, yes, we are talking about 50-50 probably. Mm. Yeah.
What is, let's say that you have a cyclist with 7 hours to train. What would a typical training week look like for them? Can you discuss like how many rides would it be? Would it be 4 rides during the week and or 3 rides during the week and 2 on the weekend and which ones would have intensity? And can you just give an example of what that might look like?
It depends a lot on the availability of each athlete, but if I could choose the disposition of these 8 hours, I would prefer to have like 2 sessions weekly, for example, Tuesday and Thursday with lots of intervals, and then leave a 4-hour ride for the weekend with just easy spinning.
So that would be only 3 rides, but...
Yeah.
Okay, so 2 hours on Tuesday, 2 hours on Thursdays, intervals in both of them, and then 4 hours easy on the weekend.
Yeah.
Okay. What about periodization? How do you think about periodization?
Yeah, periodization comes from originally, I think, from Matveyev, which was a Russian guy who took this concept from sociology studies. But in the end, and this is, you know, we are talking lots about this stuff in current science. The fact is that we don't have any scientific evidence to support that any kind of periodization nowadays works better than the other. There have been lots of studies regarding training intensity distributions, which we have also seen that in general, even if you prefer volume or intensity, in the end, the results in the same, more or less, results. But as for periodization, we don't have any studies to rely on. So it's a matter of experience. I don't like to think lots in the long term, because in the end you will always find stuff that occurs, for example, injuries, the athlete gets sick. So from what you have planned in September to what's finally done in June, it has nothing to do. Okay, so for me, planning in the very long term has zero sense. The fact is you need to know what is your objective. So, for example, I know I'm doing this Ironman. You need to know what do you need to perform in this Ironman, and you start with the most, with what, which, what is most broad to the most, digamos, specific. No. Mm.
Yeah. No, that makes total sense, and it's very similar to how I would think about it as well. And recovery. I mean, we. Yeah. Well, how do you, let's be more specific than just recovery, because I think with recovery, most people say, oh, sleep and nutrition is super important. Of course, that is one thing, but with recovery within the training program. So how do you have like a specific format that you like to give 2 or 3 harder weeks and 1 easy week, or like, how do you bake recovery into the program?
Yeah, I would like to highlight one specific factor just before starting with the training part, which is for any amateur athlete, the most important factor affecting recovery and the outcome of the training program will be their own work, what they are doing outside training. So if you have a very physical job, for example, then you are in trouble. Okay, and that's it, because you are performing like the training load of a pro athlete, but in the end, what will transfer to your performance will be just half of that. Okay, because the rest is just fatigue that accumulates during your job. So this is a very important factor that should be taken into account in every single program that is proposed to an amateur athlete. And starting with the training factors, I don't have any specific structure, because it depends a lot of, in amateur athletes, it depends on the job they have. And in pro athletes, it depends also on the specific goal they have. So I have like athletes who perform 3 hard weeks and then 1 rest week. But then I have athletes also that perform like almost 6 high intensity sessions per week. For example, I have an athlete who races in criteriums, who has like 6 hours per week for training, 1 hour each day in the turbo trainer. And I would say it's like 80% of intensity for him. Eh? So, and no rest days, because if we start training 6 hours per week with 1 hour each day, and we also want to incorporate total rest days, and we are going nowhere. So it depends a lot on the individual. So I have no specific structures, but as I told you earlier, I like to test a little bit at the start of each important session, whether the RPE and power output are where they should be in order to continue.
Is that like a Lambert cycling test or something similar when you say that you test the RPE and the power output?
Yeah, it depends on the session. So, for example, if you are going to do like VO2 max intervals, imagine that you have 4 intervals of 3 minutes. I will just incorporate after the warm up like one interval of 1 minute at this intensity, and test whether the RPE should be you should say okay it's 7 or 8, it's been just 1 minute, so it should be okay if I want to be in the 10 scale at the end of the 3 minute interval. Okay.
Yeah.
And if the athlete sees that it's like a 10 after the minute, and they say okay, today is not the day.
Yeah. Okay. Going back to that example of the athlete with 6 hours a week to train, I think this is really interesting. Lots of listeners are thinking about this right now, because a lot of people would say that, and I'm just playing devil's advocate here, but some people would say that, well, even if you have 6 hours to train, like you can't train like that. You will overtrain if you just do intervals, but it sounds like it's working for him. So can you just comment on that a little bit?
Well, I think this is a very specific case, because we are talking about a guy who races in criteriums, as I told you. So these are like neuromuscular intervals, super short, super intense. But in the end, it's quite reasonable to recover from them from one day to the other. Eh? Mm-hmm. Okay, so, we are talking about. Yeah.
So what type of workouts? What would a typical workout look like for him?
You have like. We are talking here about criterium. So, for example, you need to do two things. First, increase your neuromuscular power. So when you are fresh, your power output at this short duration, this accelerations you have in the corners, for example. Mm-hmm. And this is also very important, the fatigue. Okay, so the work you can perform after fatigue. So the one who wins the criterium is not the one who has the fastest sprint, but who has the fastest sprint after 1 hour of sprinting. Okay.
Yeah.
So this will recreate what he will find during competitions.
Mm, okay. Got it. And within a week, if you have an athlete that has, let's say, a higher volume athlete, especially, let's say 15 hours or more, do you have like any typical, do you like to incorporate a rest day, a full rest day, and then have higher load on the other days, or do you like to keep a bit of work on every day, or any particular preferences there with the recovery within a microcycle?
Well, it depends a lot of the objective, okay? But for sure, if we are talking here about 15 hours per week, then for sure he will have at least one, probably two rest days per week, okay? And imagine that you are planning to race, like a cycling sportive, which is 6 hours long. It's very interesting also to look for muscular adaptations that occur just after fatigue. So, for example, you will have a hard interval session on Saturday, and then a 4 hour zone two ride on Sunday, for example. And it's very important to perform this session under fatigue from the previous day. Okay. Mm.
Yeah. Then I want to ask a little bit about when you have worked in triathlon and also trail running, but especially triathlon, and when you compare that to road cycling, can you talk a bit about the differences? Like what are, of course, they are both endurance sports, so there are some similarities, some big similarities between them, but what are some differences that you would say exist between road cycling and triathlon in particular?
Yeah, I think that there are like two main differences between these ports. As for the trial running, you have this eccentric component, which generates lots of fatigue, and also you have impact. This means you will have higher rates of injuries. You need to be very careful about the volume you can perform while running. So, for example, for this kind of athletes, it's very important to add cycling to their workouts, because in the end, you can perform lots of easy stuff on the bike also.
Yeah.
And if you reduce the time you spend running, especially in this kind of terrain, which has lots of downhills, which are, you know, quite eccentric, it will reduce the risk of injury. And as for the triathlon, there's one specific thing, which is the swimming part, which is, in my opinion, counterproductive to the other two sports. So when you are working in the swimming pool, you are in some cases producing adaptations that are against what you would expect to perform better while running or on the bike. No, so you need to know when to prioritize swimming during the.
What are the counterproductive adaptations that you think exist?
Yeah, in swimming compared to the other two activities, you are executing the muscular force under, let's say, no gravity conditions. Okay, so this is a kind of it's completely different to what you find in the muscular contractions that are part of cycling or running, and especially you are training your upper body in a way that is completely nonsensical for running or cycling.
Sure. Yeah. That's true. Yeah. So and other than so basically, what you were saying is that how do you balance the swimming versus the bike and the run then in triathlon?
Yeah.
So what is your solution to that? Like, what are your thoughts on how to balance those disciplines?
Well, to tell you the truth, I'm not the most experienced guy here regarding swimming. I'm also not a super fan of swimming anyway. But I like to look at the great picture and say, okay, during an Ironman, for example, the most time is spent while running and while cycling. Okay, so the best increments in performance can be found there. So when you ask me what should I prioritize, I will always tell you the bike and running against swimming. Mm-hmm. So let's say that the time you spend at the swimming pool will not reflect in time margins as good as the time invested while cycling or running.
Okay? Yeah. And are there any things that you think that in general road cyclists could learn from triathletes, or vice versa, triathletes could learn from road cyclists?
Well, here I think that road cycling is is an older sport than the other two. Okay, so we have like more experience and more specific training programs here, because in the end, with the apparition of power meters, of mobile power meters, it's quite easy to monitor, especially performance in road cycling, which is not the case in triathlon, specifically with swimming, and also trail running. Well, we have seen power meters for running, like Stride. I have yet to see whether they are reliable or not, because we have seen some reported figures of 3% reliability for Stride, but that's not independent testing. But still, I think that it's quite easier to monitor performance in cycling than in the other two sports. I think that trail runners should learn to rest a little bit more from the other sports, because in the end, it's like the rates of injuries we are seeing in trail running are exceptional. They are super high, and specifically for people who have started to run like 1 year ago and they are already running for 50 kilometers in the mountains after 1 year, which is terrible. And I think that triathletes in general, from what I have seen, tend to do too much intensity work, given, especially we are talking here about Olympic distance or Ironmans, they should prioritize much more volume against intensity, okay, from what I have seen.
Yeah. What about, is there anything that you see that cyclists could learn from triathletes or from trail runners?
Yeah, I think the part of improvisation. So, in you know, as we have everything super controlled in road cycling, when something goes against the plan during a training session, the cyclist is like, oh my God, it's terrible. But for example, when you go trail running and you want to perform an interval, some days you will find that it's just the terrain doesn't allow you to do it as good as you would like to, and it's okay. It happens, and it happens every day, and it's normalized during the training session, which is not the case with the cyclist. So if a cyclist doesn't perform the interval as for the power output requested, it's like a terrible for him, you know.
I think triathletes can also learn that from trail runners for sure. I think it's the exact same thing with triathletes. One other training topic that I want to get into that I know you wrote about on your blog is about torque training. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, during the last 2 to 3 years, there are, you know, several relevant sports scientists who are talking lots about the supposed benefits of this kind of training. I have yet to see the, you know, strong scientific evidence to support this fact. I have not seen it. In my experience, you have to be very careful with this kind of intervals because they can produce several kind of injuries, such as a return of pain in Osgood-Schlatter disease or all kind of patellar problems, okay? And also, in my experience, I have seen very little benefit in general. I have seen some improvements in gross efficiency, especially in high-level cyclists, in pro cyclists. But it's very difficult, you know, to say that this is due to torque work, because in the end, yeah, I have improved more than last year. But this is because I have incorporated this kind of work, or just a coincidence. Okay, so it's very difficult to monitor these changes and say, okay, this is because of that. So I would be very careful with these assumptions and would say at least be very careful and take into account the risks and the possible benefits if you are going to incorporate that kind of session, because in the end they are also very very fatiguing from a muscular point of view. Okay, so if you perform this kind of intervals, the next day you will be probably completely worn out. Okay.
When you refer to like some like scientists that have written about it or talked about it, who is it? In case people want to go and read more about that, who do you refer?
Yeah, I am talking here about the responsibles of performance from the UAE team, from Pogacar's team.
Yeah, yeah.
So they are talking lots of good stuff about this training, which I do believe that it works for them. But I, you know, as always, I want to see the evidence. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. It's Jerome Swartz and John Wakefield, I believe.
Yeah.
Mostly. Yeah, that's what I thought. And yeah, they are available on Twitter, so people can go and have a. Yeah, I read at what they're saying, and they have some blogs as well. One more question on torque. When you have implemented it in the training of your athletes, have you tried like different durations and intensities, like everything from really high intensity, like 1 minute, 2 minute efforts, 30 second efforts, to 20 minute tempo efforts, or is there? Have you tried one particular type? But what is your experience there?
Yeah, I have tried the type of intervals that are being talked about on social media. So we are talking here about
8x4.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, got it. And now moving on a bit to some scientific questions. If you could wish for 1 to 3 areas within sports science that there would be more research done, what would those areas or those topics be?
Well, I think in the first place will be female elite performance, because most of the studies are being performed on men, which is a pity, because in the end, we do want women to take part in the sport and, of course, in elite sport. And if we do not have evidence that supports how training works for them. Adds a little bit of improvisation to the training programs that we can propose, and that's a pity. So I think that we all scientists should, you know, try to incorporate women into the sample size, into the samples in the studies, which is not easy because it's very difficult to recruit broad samples of women in general in this kind of sports. Okay, but we need to try more. Afterwards, I would say doping is a topic that we should address more in scientific studies, which is also very difficult because in the end, you have an ethical committee that won't allow you to perform, doping programs on volunteers to see the effects on doping, which I think is something that we should do, because in the end you are always talking about the EPO or testosterone, but when you try to find papers talking about the possible improvements in performance, we do have some about EPO, but for example for testosterone the evidence is lacking. So, we are saying that, okay, you cannot use testosterone because it's performance enhancing, but how much? We do not know. Okay, and that should be covered. And I think also this is a recent topic, and it's being talked about a lot in the recent years. It's the transitioning, the transgender sport, and whether we are talking just about the amount of testosterone, which this topic has been reduced to that, whether we allow a transgender to participate in female sport just because of the testosterone levels are as of a woman or not. I think that should be covered a little bit more, because in the end, when you are transitioning, there are lots of other stuff going on that can, you know, enhance your performance. And we are not talking only about testosterone, so we need to cover that also.
Yeah. What about the application of science into practice? I mean, in some ways, we have talked about this entire interview, and you said at one point that there's not so much science, or that a lot of it is kind of experience, I guess. But can you talk a little bit more about how you feel about applying science into practice?
Yeah, the problem with science is that it's performed under a controlled environment. So imagine that you perform a study on volunteers, and you know that during the 8 weeks of duration of the study, these volunteers are doing nothing but training. Okay. So you know that you will set up a training session with this kind of intervals for Monday, and then this kind of intervals for Wednesday. The athlete will be rested and well prepared for the training, but this is not what you find in real world. So if you want to extrapolate that to what you will find in real world, the athlete will perform the intervals of Monday, but he will have a lot of work, for example, going on Tuesday. He will be super fatigued and he won't be able to complete the intervals of you have programmed for Wednesday. No, and that means that the program proposed by science doesn't work. No. It's just, you know, you have changed the context. No? Mm-hmm. So that's the part in which the experience of the coach is very important to say, okay, that's what I have read in the study, but is this applicable to the context of this athlete?
Yeah, for sure. Any other challenges than the context or anything else on this question?
I think that currently we have big trouble to translate the scientific results to the practical field, because you can perform scientific studies, but you also need people who can interpret them and translate these results to the coaching field. So for many coaches, it is difficult to understand PubMed and all the science, the statistics, etc. So there have been several platforms that have started publishing results of studies in the last months on Instagram, Twitter, etc., which I found quite interesting. Knowledge is What is one of them, because in the end they are sharing the scientific knowledge and without the complication of trying to interpret all these statistical results in the studies.
Yeah. I mean, I love those accounts, Knowledge is What. I follow them. It's great. At the same time, they do remove some of that. You don't understand the context and the control of the study when you just look at an Instagram post that just shows the highlights of the results basically from a study. So it's a bit of a tricky balance basically to like, yeah, you need to make science more accessible and more available, but at the same time, when you simplify it to that degree, then you also sometimes you lose a lot of the context that is still really important to really make the best use of it.
I agree with you, but they are working on that. For example, Knowledge is What in particular, which is the page I know, are going to release like a short monthly journal in which six to seven experts will comment on the studies. Mm-hmm. And it will be like easy to understand. I'm one of the editors for this job, and it will be easy to understand for the reader and easy to implement. So I think that's another great idea.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah. And what is your advice to athletes and coaches that are interested in sports science and about basically how can they be one? And I guess one of the things that we should say, well, you can follow something like Knowledge is What. That would be a great starting point. Are any other things, any other tips for how athletes and coaches can be more effective in learning about sports science and using it effectively in training?
Yeah, I will say something that it's very hard to hear for many people, but the best investment you can make in your own coaching business is to learn how to interpret scientific studies. So learn about statistics, learn about science, because in the end you will be able to access to information that is very recent. Understand that information and implement that information into your training practice before any other person. So this will give you like a boost, no? So yeah, it's lots of work, lots of studying, but I think that the investment is fantastic in this case. So learn how to interpret science.
Yeah, yeah. And what are there any good resources for? Where do you recommend people start? Like if you don't have time to go and do a bachelor's and a master's degree, What would your recommendation be? Where can people learn about how to do that?
I don't think you need a bachelor's degree to learn how to interpret science. In fact, when you see the programs of a bachelor's degree, you will see that there's just one subject that teaches you how to interpret science. Mm. Okay, so it's like I will start. For example, there are several interesting channels on YouTube in which they show you how PubMed works. There are channels about basic statistics. I think that, you know, it's a matter of several months of watching these videos, hearing some podcasts, and in the end you will have, you know, more knowledge than any, you know, bachelor's degree student on how to interpret science. Yeah,
yeah,
it's
yeah.
just a question of time.
Is there anything else that I should have asked that I didn't ask? Anything that you're interested in or passionate about within training or within science that you want to also mention for listeners?
Yeah, I think there's one topic I would like to cover briefly, which is the professional intrusion that we are suffering in our profession in general, but specifically in the last years, because many people have seen that this is a very lucrative business if you coach many athletes. And we have like lots and lots of people who are coaching who have no formal education, behind their backs. And even if you have lots of knowledge and experience, I think that it's very important to also show like a formal basis to all of this, because in the end, you are playing with the people's health. Okay, so it's like a nutritionist, a physiotherapist, etc. I think that we are seeing many people of this kind that in the end, if you are already you have already been working in this field for 10 years, you have earned sufficient money to pay for a university degree and do it. Okay.
Mm. Yeah, that's fair. It's an unregulated like area or industry. So which, I mean, in a way it has positives and negatives, but definitely you definitely see and a lot of athletes come to, for example, to our business with like having had really bad experiences with coaches. So but and so I mean in one way you could see that, well, okay, that's like good, it gives more athletes to other coaches in the end anyway, but it doesn't really work like that. It's really bad for the people that suffer from the consequences of of poor coaching, for sure. Let's move on to the rapid fire questions. So take just one sentence to answer each of these. And the first one is, what is your favorite book or resource related to endurance sports?
There's a book written by Asker Jokendrup, which is called Sports Nutrition. And I always like to say that if you want to perform, you need to be properly fueled. So I think this is an important topic to cover, and you should learn about nutrition before you start training.
Mm. And what is an important habit that you have benefited from athletically, professionally, or personally?
In general, in my life, waking up early has been an excellent habit.
And who's somebody that you look up to or that has inspired you?
Here I would say Louis Passfield, who passed away quite recently. I had a very interesting conversation with him, and he was always willing to share his scientific knowledge, so that goes for him.
Yes, yeah. Louis is a past guest on the podcast, and it was very sad to hear about his passing. Thoughts to him, his family, and friends. Finally, Sebastian, where can people find you online and on social media?
Yeah, people can find me on my website or Instagram or Twitter as Shitko Training. It was the same name for all three.
All right, perfect.
Website and social media.
I'll put that in the show notes. Thank you so much. It's been great to chat to you, and looking forward to doing it again another time.
Okay, Michael, thank you for the invitation.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com, and you can find the links that were mentioned throughout this interview. Next Monday, we will have a Q&A on swim training for triathlon, and this episode is already recorded by the time that you hear this interview, so there is no more time to send in questions for that Q&A, but keep your ears and eyes peeled, and you will hear when we announce request for questions for future Q&As. Of course, there will be bike and run training episodes to follow, as you might have guessed, so if you want to send in questions for those already, then feel free, and I will note them down and keep them safely stored. If you want to improve your triathlon performance and want help to achieve your goals and improve your performance, then consider working with one of our coaches or training plans. Whether you're just getting into triathlon or trying to set a new PB or qualify for a championship event, or even want to race professionally, we have experience in all of those scenarios and would love to discuss further around if and how we can help you on your triathlon journey. So you can find out more and contact us on scientifictriathlon.com, and we can discuss your specific goals and needs and see what's best for you. Big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. Use their free fuel and hydration planner to understand your fluid, electrolyte, and carbohydrate needs and get a specific and effective race strategy, and book a free video consultation with the team if you want to refine it further. Use the code TTS23 at checkout for 15% off your first order. And thank you to Zen8. Use the Zen8 swim trainer to improve your technique, power, stamina, and swim training consistency. You can try the Zen8 risk-free for up to 30 days and get a special Zen8 plus TTS bundle, including the swim trainer and a number of Zen8 training plans and on-demand workouts on zen8swimtrainer.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving craft.